Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. Some farmers and food producers are facing the start of new federal rules designed to improve safety. The Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, brings significant requirements for food growers, processors, and packagers. In the next hour, we'll hear about what it will take to bring tribal organizations up to speed. We'll also talk to opponents who say the process is a blow to tribal sovereignty. Join us for this conversation right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native parents in Los Angeles are turning to an Indian center for support. Families face a number of challenges living in a large urban area, and some parents may not have access to services or help from their family or tribe. Through a fellowship with the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism and the Dennis A. Hunt Health Journalism Fund, we travel to LA and look at a program which parents are turning to for assistance. David Magisi Diaz and April Cardenas both grew up in the L.A. area and now have an infant son together. She's Seminole Creek and he's Seminole and Pima.
Because the bills, living in the city in L.A. especially, it gets expensive.
I still don't have my my license, so it's really complicated. I have to take an Uber from my house to the train station and the 20 to 30 minute ride over here.
Minimum wage in Los Angeles was raised this summer from $10.50 an hour to $12, while the average cost of rent for a one-bedroom apartment is nearly $2,000. The couple initially came to the Southern California Indian Center for help with necessities like diapers, but also found a place where they feel comfortable talking about other issues.
And a lot of people think that we're from over the border, a lot of racism that goes on and a lot of just misconceptions.
Parents like David and April are taking part in the American Indian Family Partnership Program, which has been at the center for 8 years.
I like coming to these programs. It's really cool. Like I said, it's all about family for them, and that kind of makes me feel at home. I've never really had a family, and this is really cool.
Many parents are in crisis when they first arrive, says Raymond Estrella, an outreach counselor who's Yaqui.
And it's really a program that helps them get back on their feet. They're in emergency mode right now. They're not thinking about tomorrow, or they're hungry and they need stuff right now.
After those immediate needs are met, families can focus on healthy living, including assisting high-risk moms who have experienced abuse or need services. Vivian Garcia is Cherokee Nation and came to the center for support after her daughter was born. She says while transportation, jobs, and housing are among the many challenges facing Native people in LA, she also yearned to connect with other Native Americans.
So being here, just taking the classes and knowing that I just wasn't alone in this journey was really the biggest blessing for me, because it did kind of restore that faith that, you know, I can do this, I'm not alone, and there is help.
Parents are encouraged to go through training, which promotes health, safety, and a nurturing environment. Cultural activities go side by side with services, such as beading and cradleboard making, says Pamela Smith, Navajo, who works with families in the program.
There'll be grandmas, aunts, you know, uncles, and everybody would come in and work with the cradleboard. So it's like when that baby is in that cradleboard, everybody has a hand on that cradleboard. So it's like the whole family is there constructing this carrier for the baby, for them to be safe, and it's nothing but good thoughts.
One of the biggest challenges for the Southern California Indian Center is funding cuts, but the organization is working to adapt programs with current funding. Families who benefit from services at the center maintain it helps them reconnect to their Native culture while providing a support system. The Cherokee Nation does not intend to file an appeal in the tribe's citizenship case involving Cherokee Freedmen descendants. This week, a federal court ruled Freedmen descendants have a right to membership, which the Oklahoma tribe disputes. Descendants of slaves known as freedmen were once owned by Cherokee people. The court pointed to an 1800s treaty as a means of entitlement for descendants. The tribe has started processing applications. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios, by Quantic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate 48 million people get sick from food every year in the U.S. The agency says an average of 3,000 of those people die. The Food Safety Modernization Act is designed to protect people from those illnesses. It's the first sweeping federal food reform law passed in almost a century. And agricultural businesses have to start complying with new rules and regulations as early as next year. Some say it's confusing and complicated policy that tribes are having to navigate. And some tribal agricultural professionals are saying it's a policy that's stepping over their tribal sovereignty. In this hour, we'll talk about what it means for tribes and their agricultural practices and businesses. If you have questions about the Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, as it's commonly referred to, give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And right now, it's our pleasure to go to Fayetteville, Arkansas, to say hello to Janie Sims Hip, where she is the director of the Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative at the University of Arkansas School of Law. And she is Chickasaw. Janie, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Janie, we throw out these words in terms of what's being put on the table, regulations that need to happen, the Food Safety Modernization Act. Please explain a little bit of what FSMA, as it's called, what it is, and how is it going to affect our tribal nations. Go ahead.
Well, it's a very complex law. It was, as you said in the intro, probably the most sweeping new changes to food safety laws that have occurred with regard to produce, particularly, but also with regard to other issues like animal feed and some other areas. But it has been many, many decades since Congress has enacted something as sweeping as FSMA. It is. It was originally signed into law by President Obama in January of 2011. And in 2013, the Food and Drug Administration, which is the lead agency, I need to make a special note on that. The Food and Drug Administration is a part of the Health and Human Services Department of federal government. USDA has some authority in the area of produce, but not very much. And USDA's authority really extends more in the meat, poultry, and eggs arena of food safety. And so the primary federal agency involved in this is the Food and Drug Administration. So they passed their draft rules to bring life to the law that Congress passed. Those were released in 2013. We myself and several other folks were involved in NCAI particularly, were involved in working with FDA to highlight the need for working with tribal governments and tribal communities and citizens around how these rules were going to affect us, because the original draft rules were didn't mention us hardly at all, and very little consultation had been done with regard to the to those rules before they were released. But FDA did back up and really start to talk more specifically with tribal leadership as well as key individuals in Indian country about how these rules were going to affect us. And so when they actually put in place the final rules, which were released in 2015, there were some key changes that were put in place that we believe go towards recognizing tribal sovereignty in these spaces. But we still have a lot of work to do, and I'll let you go forward with some questions so we can kind of dig into these.
And when you say things in place to respect sovereignty, can you break that down or give us some specifics?
Yeah, the one specific that I can point to for sure is the original draft of the rules recognized the rights of state governments and foreign governments to request variances of the actual language in the rules. And it did not recognize tribal governments. But when FDA put in place the final rules, they recognized the role of tribal governments to actually be able to request variances of the rules themselves. You know, so that is one example of, and it's probably the most important example I can give you, where they did recognize the importance of sovereignty in these spaces. However, I will tell you that in order to actually seek and obtain a variance, the tribal government itself needs to have in place a food safety law themselves, and it's got to match the components of the federal law, because that's the way variances and waivers work. And tribal governments are usually pretty familiar with how that whole arena works in the context of other issues. So that's one area that we are involved in, too, in our offices, is to build out the food code issues that are going to have to be put in place by tribal governments in order to bring life, if you will, to that authority to request variances of these rules.
And as to date, are there any tribes who have their own food safety law or are currently drafting them? Does anybody have it on the books? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, actually, there are some tribes that have these on the books. There is what is called a model food code. It's been around for a long time. And it actually is a combined effort of the Food and Drug Administration and USDA, and it literally sets the standards for, in a model way, for other governmental authorities who function in the area of retail food establishments. And so there are several tribes who have recognized the model food code at the federal level. And it's usually those tribes that have retail food establishments that exist within their jurisdictions. For instance, retail settings in relation to a casino, you know, retail food establishment that's under that roof, if you will. So there are some tribes who have inspectors of those facilities, and you have to have the recognition of a model food code in your laws, if you will, or in your policies, in order to actually stand up an inspector who can inspect those places. But, you know, it's not the next step in all of this is to literally take this to the next level. And what is unique and new about FSMA is that it takes food safety regulation and what is called the hazard analysis critical control point process of doing internal risk assessment around food safety, and it presses it all the way down to the farm itself where produce is grown. And so that is the most unique piece of this puzzle. The hazard analysis critical control point analysis has been in the meat sector for 15 years at least. And so the meat side of the house is very familiar with how HACCP, and I'm calling it HACCP because that's what that stands for, they're very familiar with how HACCP works. It's just unique that it's been pushed into the produce side of the house, which is fruits and vegetables.
And so when we think about our communities, and we are going to hear from one tribal nation that has a program that is up and running. But a lot of times we think of maybe the smaller farms. And Janie, start us off there. When in terms of some of these smaller farms, are they going to have trouble complying as opposed to some of the larger agricultural industries? Go ahead.
There's a lot of talk out there that they will. I personally believe that the biggest, you know, challenge that we have is to get the word out and to get folks to come into these trainings that we're putting together. We're using the standard curriculum that the Produce Safety Alliance has run through FDA, and FDA has approved the curriculum. And so this curriculum is quite extensive, and it can literally break down each particular subject matter area that the rules cover and can literally kind of unpack it for you as you sit through this training. And we can do the training in a day, one day. And so a part of that training is record keeping. A part of that training is actually understanding how the rules themselves work. But I think you have to actually look at each particular farm and to determine how much of a challenge anybody's going to have. We've done some of our trainings, and people will be in the audience, and they'll say, well, I'm already doing this. Or they will be a farm that is already in a commercial retail environment, like a regional grocery store or something like that. And maybe whoever is purchasing their foods at that retail level is already requiring them to be GAP certified or some other certification as to their practices and the food safety, you know, viability of their practices. But then we also have people who come who've never heard some of these issues, and so it is a steeper learning curve for them. But the rules apply regardless of your size, and the rules apply because you know, bacteria, viruses, microorganisms relating to food safety don't really care what size you are. They show up and they, you know, get inside our food system in very, you know, sneaky ways, if you will. I'm trying to put myself in the position of a virus or bacteria. But the reality is that food safety really doesn't speak to quality or, you know, the special nature of our foods. It really speaks to something that is microorganism related. And so the rule itself has built into it different classifications, if you will, of size of operation. And so the bigger operations have had to come to terms and comply with these rules already. Their time period for compliance has already passed. If you go out to a really large operation right now, anywhere, then they should have already been trained up and should already have their record keeping in place and should already be trying to meet the components of the rules. The way these things were rolled out is the small and the very small operators have the longest period of time to really understand the rule and start to put things in place to comply with the rule. So, you know, it really totally depends on what you're already doing or how you set up your farm operation as to how much of a challenge you're going to have in actually, you know, coming to terms with the rules. So in some cases, you may be doing everything that the rules say, but you don't have a good record-keeping system in place. And so the training pieces that we're pulling together and that we're doing all over the place can help people really kind of get more familiar with the rules, but also think about how they can set up their operations records in such a way to be able to prove it if an inspector comes on their property.
And so, Janie, if people are interested in receiving training, how does it work? Do you go anywhere? Do people have to come to you? Please don't say any prices, but go ahead and give details.
Well, we're doing our training free, so there are no prices other than, you know, you getting to one of the locations where we're doing our training. Our first year of actually, we were identified as the national holder of a cooperative agreement with the Food and Drug Administration to actually stand up training. And so we're out there already. I have my staff who just came back from Albuquerque, for instance, earlier this week and did a training there. And so what we've tried to do is stand up regionally based trainings, but we've also shifted our focus in the last couple of months. And if you can, you know, gather up 10 or 12 people so that we can, you know, get enough. It's going to be very hard for us to get to one or two people at a time because of the cost of actually getting our people out there, right? And so what we're shifting to in the year two of this agreement that we have with FDA is to literally, you call us, if you've got 10 or 12 people that we can come to and do a training on site, then just tell us when. And we will do our best to work with you to set up a time and location, and we're going to continue to do regional training so that, you know, people can come into an Albuquerque or to an Oklahoma City or to a Spokane or, you know, wherever. We've got some coming up all throughout the rest of this year, and we're developing our schedule for next year, but we're flexible, and we can get our trainers to folks if they can just give us a holler and JHIPP@UARK.edu is the best place to reach me, and or you can just go on our website and send us an email to our general email address.
Okay, and give that website.
It's IFAI. It's Indigenous Food and Ag .com.
Okay, thank you for that. And folks, if you got questions directly for Janie on some of this, or maybe you're hearing about this and you have concerns of, am I in compliance? Give us a call. Maybe you know all about this and you've been shifting things, and tell us a little bit about that journey. Give us a call. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Well, let's hear from some of these folks who are seeing this as well. We're going to go to Farmington, New Mexico to say hello to Danae John. She is the Cultural Testing and Research Lab Manager at the Navajo Agricultural Products Industry, also known as NAPI. Danae is Navajo and Turtle Mountain Chippewa. Danae, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Danae, I know some of this can get complicated real fast, and just talking about rules and policies. Anything that you heard from Janie that you think you know, you'd like to add, or just trying to create more awareness and understanding about these rules and what they mean for the people who are producing? Anything more you want to expand on?
Well, she pretty much covered, did a good detail of covering it, and something that it is important to have these kind of rules to follow. We produce food for people to eat, and food safety is important because we don't want to harm people. So food safety should be a priority when you're growing products.
Indeed. And so were there any aspects of your operation that changed because of FSMA?
Well, we've actually, I've been here for 4 years, and in those 4 years, we haven't had to change anything because we've already had HACCP plants for all of our crops, and our food processing facilities are certified through third parties for food safety. So a lot of these requirements we've had in place, and keeping everything current.
And so tell us a little bit more about NAPI, you know, the size of the operation, what's being grown, and who are you sending this to?
Well, our farm is 72,000 acres. The crops that we grow are potatoes, wheat, beans, corn, alfalfa, melons. Oh, most recently, we've expanded our organics program, so we're growing organic melons, squash, and onions. And then also we have different native foods that we also grow here. Customers that we have can be Farm Fresh Direct. Most recent one is Robinson Fresh. They're buying a lot of our organic products. And then we even have our scales here that provide products to community members. They can come up and purchase products here on the farm.
And so just understanding more about this, is there anything more you'd like to say about how NAPI is in compliance with FSMA?
Well, the way that we're in compliance with FSMA here at NAPI, like I'd mentioned earlier, we have our HACCP plans, the Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point plans for all of our crops. Another thing we do is we do test our water to check the microbial limits to make sure we're in compliance. And then also one of the most important things is that all of our employees are trained in food safety prior to working for NAPI, and then on an annual basis after that.
And so what are some of the examples of how people are trained? I know we're talking about being in compliance or making rules, but what actually is it that people have to know and implement when we say, that people have been trained? Can you give us an example?
Well, the training that they take, they actually take three of them. The first one is called Good Agricultural Practices. These are a list of rules that they have to follow when they're working out on the field. For instance, paying attention to when you're supposed to wash your hands, making sure not to wear any kind of jewelry when they handle product or work with product because they are possible physical contaminants. Another one for training is good manufacturing practices. This is practices that employees follow when they're working in the processing facilities, such as our packing stations or packing sheds. Same thing, making sure they know about personal hygiene and when to wash their hands, not bringing any kind of food into the processing area because those could be possible allergen contaminants. It's just raising awareness so that they're able to identify different or specific hazards and educating them on it so that we prevent any kind of cross-contamination.
All right. Thank you for that. And folks, we're going to continue with our discussion here. And if there's any questions you have, give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And maybe you work on a farm in your tribal community. Have you heard of FSMA? Does the FSMA affect you and how you do things there? Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And earlier, we heard from our guests about tribes even implementing their own safety laws. Maybe you've been a part of that side of things. Anything you want to share about it, give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We'll look forward to your calls. And maybe you're wondering how this might even affect what you put on your kitchen table. Call us. Everybody's welcome. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Or if you're online and can't get to the phone, you can always send us a tweet at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And if you're listening to this in our archives or on a rebroadcast, you can also post directly on our website, nativeamericacalling.com. We look forward to what you have to say about all of this and maybe any questions you're still wondering about. Again, our phone lines are open. We look forward to hearing from you today. The movie Wind River has touched down in many cities across the country. It's Taylor Sheridan's creation that follows the story of a game tracker and a rookie FBI agent as they uncover the layers to the murder of a Native woman. Join us for the next Native America Calling as we turn our focus to the film's Native cast.
Support by AARP. At AARP, we create and connect you to unique tools and programs, help you save money, and tackle the issues that matter most to you, your family, and your community. What we do might surprise you, like sponsoring the Native American Journalist Association National Conference in Anaheim, California, September 7th through the 9th. Information at aarp.org. Alaska Native and American Indian people are providers, teachers, and artists. They are many things, but they are not defined by tobacco. It's a fact. Over half of Alaska Native adults don't use tobacco. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/we are. This announcement is sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back. You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo. And the Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, is sweeping a federal policy that affects how farming businesses operate. The aim is to address food safety before people get sick. But some tribal farmers and food handlers see it as a problematic policy that steps over the boundary of tribal sovereignty. If you're one of them, we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And we hear how FSMA will affect tribal agricultural business, but we want to hear maybe some of your concerns too on how it will take effect in your tribal farm or business. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with us today on the line from Fayetteville, Arkansas, is the director of the Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative at the University of Arkansas School of Law. It is Ms. Jamie Sims Hip, and she is Chickasaw. Also with us today from Farmington, New Mexico, is Danae John. She is the Agricultural Testing and Research Lab Manager at the Navajo Agricultural Products Industry, or NAPI. She's Navajo and Turtle Mountain Chippewa. Ladies, thank you for being here with us. And Danae, it's great to hear how some of this is into operation. And when it comes to NAPI, and I'm wondering, was it just good planning on the part of NAPI, or was there another wave that you got in compliance, or you know, were in line with some of this, or do you guys just got your stuff together? Tell me more. Go ahead.
Well, I believe this. We really pushed into getting certified initially when I started working here. We went into SQF, and that was a pretty tough certification to obtain. And our food safety program actually is modeled after SQF, so I think that's why it was so intense to include our whole farm in making sure that we were producing safe food, or growing safe food.
And so when you think about the size of business that you're doing there, and you think of maybe other businesses who are smaller, is it easier or harder to comply with FSMA? What do you think?
Based on the size of the company?
Mm-hmm.
I actually think the larger businesses have more of an advantage, actually due to workforce. For instance, here at NAPI, we have a large workforce, and so we do have greater assistance in monitoring our food safety programs.
All right. And let me toss that to Janie, too. What do you think? Janie,
I'm on. Mm-hmm. I tend to agree with her. I think that, if you're the size of NAPI, then you do have a lot more people who you can, bring up to speed and get involved in the day-to-day food safety, record keeping and compliance things that you need to do. If you're a smaller operation, more mom and pop, and it's only a couple of you, then it is harder just in terms of making sure that you've got all your ducks in a row and kind of keep up. And that's why, it's important, I think, to avail yourself of going to training so that you can keep, you know, some resources in your head and on your desktop at, you know, in your home office so that you can keep up. But, you know, it can be trickier for a smaller operation, but it's not also insurmountable. I mean, we had a 3-person mom and dad and son who came to one of our trainings, and you know, they walked away and said, "We're already doing a lot of this anyway." And so it's not impossible for a smaller operations, but she's right. It, when you do have a larger operation like NAPI, you do have a little bit more hands in the cookbook, if you will. It makes it easier. Yeah.
And so we've mentioned there's tribes who have concerns about FSMA. What are you hearing from growers and tribes?
Is that directed at me?
Yes.
Well, we're hearing a mix. Some tribes who are already in, like NAPI, in a commercial marketplace with their food, either, you know, at an export level or, you know, regional or local level, they already are likely moving, just as NAPI did, you know, years ago, moving towards having some sort of food safety compliance program in place, just because it opens up more markets to you, and it also makes you feel more comfortable when you're in those markets that you're meeting some generalized food safety standards and kind of doing the very best you can to make sure the food safety issues are dealt with. We are hearing a lot of, I think, misunderstanding about how the rules actually treat us as tribal operators or growers, if you will. Some folks assume that because we're tribal that we are automatically exempt from these rules, and that really is not the way they're set up. There is no legal exemption for us in these rules just because we're native or just because we grow food on tribal lands or trust lands or within reservation boundaries. You really have to unpack the issue of whether you're exempt, and it's based on many things, some of which have to do with where your food is going, but also some of it has to do with the size of your operation, and some of it has to do with how much money you make in your operation. So there's a lot of kind of general misunderstanding about how those exemptions work, and you know, that to me is a very important issue that everyone who is growing food and moving it around, regardless of whether it's to a commercial market or not, really needs to kind of ask and answer yourself, because it does depend on a lot of criteria. But we can help you with that. We can walk you through those exemptions, and you know, there's nothing that can replace really coming to the training. It's for free. You walk away with the entire book of all of the rules and all of the explanatory materials and some implementation aids as well.
All right. Well, it sounds like some relief to know that there are some folks who are there to help, to offer training, to answer questions. And we're glad you're talking about it, Janie. Folks, what would you like to share when you hear some of this? And maybe you had a big dream of starting your own business and you didn't hear of this. Maybe now you have questions. There's some folks who got good info. Give us a call. Ask away. 1-800-996-2848. We're going to go ahead and bring in another voice. We're going to go to Phoenix, Arizona to say hello to Ade Romero Briones. And she is the Associate Director of Research and Policy for Native Agriculture for the First Nations Development Institute. She is Cochiti and Kiowa. Ade, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
And Ade, we've heard about how this is working. We've heard from one of the producers. Is there anything you want to share, any thoughts you have about FSMA and how it is affecting tribes, or maybe even with the dates coming up? Go ahead.
Yes, I think Janie did such a wonderful job of describing a lot of the details in FSMA. And I think what people are most concerned is the produce safety rule. So FSMA has different rules, and the produce safety rule is one that I think we're talking about most clearly. But there are other rules, as she mentioned in the beginning, that are implemented about animal safety. We have preventative controls for human food. We have rules on third-party certifications and foreign supplier verification programs. And those are also part of FSMA and have contained their own language and contain their own processes. But what we're talking about is the produce safety rule. And so I think Janie is absolutely correct when she says that everybody should take heed to the produce safety rule. I think every farm needs to do the analysis on whether they meet one of these exemptions to the produce safety rule, but also they should keep a keen eye on how these laws are implemented within their state or what their tribe is doing to actually meet these requirements. So FSMA itself is the federal law, but how these rules are implemented and enforced at state and local levels is still yet to be determined. So there's a lot of things still to come. And one of the key components of the produce safety rule is how to regulate agricultural water. And there's still a lot of questions about what is going to come about for the agricultural water rule that is part of the produce safety rule. So we have the rule, but who's going to do the testing? How are they going to do that testing is still kind of a question in many places. So there's still a lot to come in FSMA, and it's important to become part of the conversation now and to learn about it so that we're better prepared to make our arguments or to address some of the issues that may come up for tribal communities and tribal farmers. But again, Janie did such a wonderful job of explaining the details of FSMA and the produce safety rule.
And Ade, I'd like you to go further with the water and tell us a little bit about that. You know, what are the concerns, or is it that people don't want outside sources coming in and testing our water, accessing the water? I'm unclear on that. Go ahead.
Yes, I think there's a lot of people still unclear about the agricultural water. First, what is agricultural water? And so the agricultural water is any water that would touch your produce, or so the part of the plant that would be eaten, if it touches it at any point, it can be considered agricultural water. But there's another set of rules for sanitary water that you use to clean your produce after you pick it. And so they have come out with a rule that says that the agricultural water standards are going to be the EPA recreational water standards, which have a certain coliform, which is the stuff you find in manure. But the question is, how is this going to be enforced? Who's going to do the testing? Who is it going to be, the farmer? Is it going to be the state? And many states still haven't figured out, or tribes figured out, who's going to do that testing. Is it certified water operators? Is it the farmer itself? And so those questions still have to be knitted out a little bit. But again, we have this huge rule, and we're still seeing how it trickles out to the enforcement of this rule. But the agricultural water, again, is still kind of up in the air on enforcement, so we're still keeping a keen eye on that.
All right. Thank you for that. Ade Romero-Briones here with us today from First Nations Development Institute, and there we go. Another voice of folks who are watching this closely. If there's anything you'd like to share, there's still time left in the hour. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Janie, is there anything you'd like to add about just understanding more about water quality and its connection to FSMA? Let's see if we can get Janie back. Are you there, Janie? Okay, we'll see if our control room can find her for us. Ade, we're going to continue. And we heard earlier about tribes who already have food safety policies in place. Is there any more need for tribes to come up with more safety policies?
I think the food codes that Janie mentioned are critical because they don't only it allows tribes to present their own ideas about how to protect their farmers, how to grow their agricultural communities, to even articulate their values and perceptions about food outside of the federal food codes that we see, like the model food code. And again, like Janie said, many tribes have model food codes that are relevant to retail food businesses like casinos or maybe fast food or restaurants that they may have in, within their reservation. But you can also take that a step further. Tribes can also articulate the value systems around their food. And it's a little tricky when you get into legal language about those kinds of things, but nonetheless, they're just as important. And when you have things like FSMA, and you already have your own established food codes, they have to be reconciled. And that allows the community to go through a process that, again, articulates the value of their food systems. And we can't underestimate that process, and partly because I think food is such a deeply ingrained value system, and it contains a lot of spiritual and economic and social values within the community that those should be articulated in a legal form if possible.
And so, Day, we mentioned it earlier, but I'm still unclear. Where is it, or why are people saying any of this is a challenge to sovereignty?
So I think when you have any federal agency or state agency threatening or about to come and implement or enforce rules that weren't articulated or created with tribal input, it's a challenge to sovereignty. And so like Janie explained in the beginning, these rules were designed and implemented by a federal agency, FDA, and their partners with little input from tribes. And so when you have rules that kind of are being given to you rather as opposed to being built by you, it's a challenge to sovereignty. And we did so much work at the University of Arkansas when I was there with Janie to force FDA to do some tribal consultation or at least acknowledge the fact that tribes were going to be affected by this rule and should actually have some input into how they're articulated and later enforced within tribal communities.
All right, thanks for clearing that up. Again, folks, 1-800-99-NATIVE is how you find us on Twitter, and it's also how you can call in and participate. I think we have Janie back. Janie, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry, previously.
No worries, no worries. I was asking about water, but if there's anything else you want to pick up on, go ahead.
All I'd add is, you know, Aday is correct. The water issues are an issue for the whole country. And FDA is doing some additional examination of the water components of these particular rules and all of their guidances. And a lot of that is as yet to be revealed. We don't know whether they're going to make any specific changes in the future. And it's just important, I think, to make sure that we have channels of communications open with them. And, you know, FDA has done quite a bit. They were not required under federal law to actually do a separate funding mechanism for a Native focused outreach effort, which they did do. And so I really applaud them for doing that. And the changes that they did make in the final rules, I think, were important as well. You know, the bottom line here is that as individual producers, we've got to, you know, be aware and stay aware of the rules as they change with regard to food safety. And our tribal governments have a huge role to play in this arena in terms of literally exercising the sovereignty that they do have. And you know, I don't think that we're going to necessarily see threats to that sovereignty as we move forward, but we do have our own need to have our tribal government speak in these spaces so that our positions are clear with regard to our foods, and that applies across the board in a lot of different topic areas, but it particularly applies with regard to food safety. We need those standards on the books with our tribal leadership. And so the water issue is as yet, I think, to be determined, but we know what the rules say now. We know what the guidances are now. We need to know exactly how that's going to impact us at the farm level so that we can have a solid voice as FDA continues to see if these things need to be modified over time, which they very well could be.
All right. Thank you for that, Jeannie. And Ade, when we take a look at this and how nations may be affected, is there anything you can say about the economic side of tribal farming and FSMA? Anything there?
Yes, absolutely. I think in general, agricultural businesses and farmers have been one of the most active population in tribal communities that build economies. Whether they know it or not, a lot of our communities are built on agricultural products and the people who grow them. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a rule like FSMA, of course, it kind of makes people pump the brakes a little bit and kind of figure out how resources need to go to complying with some of these rules or doing an analysis on how you're exempted from these rules. So it requires some resource flow into that arena, whether you're doing the analysis or whether you're doing the complying. And so that takes resources out of the general pool of the economy. And so, but you have to plan for those things. You have to manage those things. And the better you manage and the better you plan for those things, the healthier the cash flow is or the economics flow from that process. And so, in short, if you want to protect your tribal economy, you should plan for either compliance or the process of trying to figure out whether you're exempt from this. And the more resources and the better equipped our farmers and agricultural businesses are, the healthier our economies will be in the long run.
And Ade, what would be the reason a tribe or an entity would apply for a variance or waiver?
So there's different types of variances. So there's nomenclature here that's used. So a variance is a request to the FDA to be exempt from perhaps the whole produce safety rule. The exemption applies to businesses or farmers, and it's tied to the annual sales of either your produce or your food. And so that analysis, I believe what Janie possibly helps people do at her training. So I would recommend going to one of the trainings to see if those exemptions apply. But a variance is a government-to-government sort of ask. We're asking to be exempt because of these reasons, whether it be because that the farmers have a product that is culturally significant, perhaps, or that the farmers have certain circumstances within a community that would make it harder for them to apply. But a variance is a government-to-government ask for a specific reason. And that process hasn't really been articulated very well within FSMA, but it is there, and tribes should actually look into it. And if they have to, call the FDA to talk about the variance process.
All right. And as we continue here and learning more about this, Ade, what do you think any grower or producer really needs to understand when it comes to FSMA?
They need to understand whether they're exempt. They need to go through that process. Whether you feel like you're a farmer who only goes to farmers markets and uses your income for supplemental income, or whether you're a large operation like NAPI, like the process of going through whether this law applies to you is an important one and should not be overlooked by anyone in the agriculture or food business.
All right. And Danae, John, we go to you as well. Anything you feel is important to know about FSMA?
a day, and Jamie pretty much stated everything clearly. Like I had said earlier, also that FSMA, they have a lot of good rules that we do need to follow. Most important is to make sure that we are to ensure that we do grow safe products that we distribute to our customers.
All right, thank you for that. And Janie, anything to leave us with?
I just leave you with, don't be afraid of it. It is complicated, and it is, a large piece of legislation, but it is not impossible. And it's not impossible to understand. There's a lot more common sense embedded in it than we think. But we also just need to use our own due diligence to get involved in this and make sure that we protect our operations, but also plan for the future. It's important to really think about, as our produce operations around Indian Country, become more plentiful and more and bigger and more of them, it's not outside the realm of possibility that we're going to want to have more of those foods be sold somewhere, either on reservation or off. And as this rule kind of stays out there, it's going to be really even more necessary as we move forward to become aware of it and comply.
All right, thank you for that. And that's going to wrap it up for our program today. Janie Sims-Hipp, thank you for joining us, as well as Ade Romero Briones and Danae John. We hope you'll join us again on Monday. Monday, we're pre-recorded, and you're going to hear our visit with the native cast of the Hollywood film Wind River. You can find details on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com, on that and all the shows we have planned for next week. Thanks to the Native America Calling crew, Art Hughes, Monica Brain, Andy Murphy, and Marino Spencer. Also thanks to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News. I'm your host and producer, Tara Gatewood. Thanks again, and we are back again on Monday.
Support by the Association on American Indian Affairs Indigenous International Repatriation Conference, Journey Home, Empowering Indigenous Communities in International Repatriation. September 25th and 26th at the Isleta Resort in Albuquerque, the focus will be on learning, sharing, and discussing cultural and human rights issues of returning ancestors and cultural items to their rightful places. Information and registration at Indian-Affairs.org. Support by nonprofit community lender Acción, providing small business loans to help strengthen local economies of New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, and Texas. Acción works with entrepreneurs growing or just getting started with an easy application process and personalized one-on-one support. 9% interest loans available through the end of August. More at us.accion.org or by calling 800-508-7624.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael David. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.